What do you love about music?
To begin with, everything.
Putting on a great show is the most important thing you can do. One great rock show can change the world.
Without Chuck Berry, there is no rock and roll. I'm Greg Kot.
And I'm Jim DeRogatis. This week, we remember the life, music, and legacy of the pioneering guitarist, songwriter, and rock and roll legend, Chuck Berry. That's all coming up on Sound Opinions.
You're listening to Sound Opinions. I'm Greg Kot with Jim DeRogatis, and typically at this time of year, we are doing our South by Southwest Music Conference wrap-up from Austin, Texas. Jim and I just returned from there, and we will do that show
in another week.
But even bigger news this week to talk about, the death of Chuck Berry. It is not an overstatement to say that he is one of the, if not the key figure in the evolution of rock and roll in the 20th century. A figure that ranks up there with stylists along the lines of Louis Armstrong, who played a key role in the invention of jazz, or Bill Monroe in bluegrass, Thomas Dorsey in gospel, W.C. Handy in blues. Chuck Berry played a similar role in the way rock and roll evolved. There is rock and roll such as we knew it before Chuck Berry and then after. Not only as a singer and performer, he was a great, great showman, but as a guitar player, influencing every guitar player, every electric guitar player who ever picked up the instrument afterward, and most of all as a songwriter, the subject matter of those songs influencing the way rock and roll was viewed as a music of freedom. And also as the leader of a small combo that played an up-tempo blend of blues and country with a heavy backbeat. Virtually every rock and roll band that has been invented ever since has followed the format that Chuck Berry ingrained in our consciousness in the 1950s.
Chuck Berry died on March 18th. He was 90 years old. He was at home in the St. Louis suburb of Wentzville. Hopefully what we will do in this hour of Sound Opinions is dig a lot deeper into the life and the legacy of one of the most important musicians in the history of rock and roll, offer some insights. He was born 1926 into a middle-class family in St. Louis, an African-American neighborhood called The Ville. He's the fourth of six children, and his dad is a contractor and a deacon at the Baptist Church. His mother is a public school principal, which I think is really ironic considering how much Chuck will later sing about school days. First public performance, 1941, while he's at Sumner High School, and then he goes to jail for the first time. Chuck has a troubled life and four notable run-ins with the law, and we will discuss that later because it cannot be avoided. It's part of the man's story. He turns to music fairly late in life, 27, 28 years old. He's out of prison. He's married. He has a family. He's, for all intents and purposes, a grown man. He has gone to the Poro College of Cosmetology. He's a cosmetician or a beautician. He's all set. But then he catches the musical bug. Early 1953, he begins performing with a trio led by Johnny Johnson, an incredibly talented piano player who was a key part, often overlooked, of the Chuck Berry story. Berry takes over this trio led by Johnny Johnson, makes it his own, plays around St. Louis quite a bit, and for reasons that still remain unclear, even if you've read his biography, he thinks he can do more. He goes to Chicago in 1955. Muddy Waters, a blues hero, makes the introduction to Leonard Chess, the main fellow at Chess Records. And over the next 10 or 15 years, Chuck records an extraordinary series of hits for Chess Records. an incredibly fruitful period that is broken up in the middle by another stint in jail. For all intents and purposes, though, after Chuck leaves Chess and signs up with Mercury Records, his career is pretty much over. Mm. The only number one pop hit of his lifetime comes in the early 70s with My Ding-a-Ling, nobody's favorite Chuck Berry song, although, like I said, it was number one hit. And then he really kind of stops recording, but will play over the remaining four decades of his life in pickup bands as an oldies act for cash. There is some indication that he was going to be celebrated again as a recording artist because his first album in four decades of new material is coming. It will be released on June 16th. It's called Chuck, but Chuck died before its release. As I said, 90 years old, March 18th in Wentzville, Missouri. So to get the historical perspective on Chuck Berry and where he fits in those years that gave birth to rock and roll, we have our old friend Greg, Ed Ward from Austin, Texas. Ed's book came out in November, The History of Rock and Roll, Volume 1, 1920 to 1963. Welcome to Sound Opinions, Ed.
Ah, good to be here.
We thought it would be particularly useful to have you on to put Chuck Berry in some perspective because those records really set the rock and roll template. I think everyone agrees for that. But they didn't come out of a vacuum. So
no.
Give us some perspective on Mr. Berry.
Well, I mean, he was a middle-class black kid in the suburbs of St. Louis who grew up idolizing T-Bone Walker and Louis Jordan. And had this idea of doing songs with narrative. Although most of the work when he first started playing guitar that was available was blues work. It's very interesting that the first recording session he ever played was Calypso from some guy in St. Louis who thought he was a Calypso artist.
I left Trinidad a few years ago, and the shrimps and rice that I love so, I took out the boat for USA. Maria, she run me away. Oh,
but one thing that Calypso is real good on is social commentary and narrative. So that idea was planted in his head.
New Jersey Turnpike in the wee hours. I was rolling slow because of drizzling showers. Yeah, come a flat top, he was moving up with me. Then come waving goodbye in a little old souped-up jitney. I put my foot in my tank and I began to roll. Moaning siren towards the state patrol. So I let out
What's
my
really interesting, though, is that Chuck Berry was actually kind of old when he first started going. I mean, he was born in 1926, and Maybelline was 1955, which would have made him 29 years old. He must have had the idea that teenage kids were worth writing to and about, and yet I'm not sure how much of his own experience he was using to do that. But after he had a couple of hits, he really did zone in on the teenage experience, which obviously he was getting to observe now at first hand by doing all the touring and so forth that he was doing.
You know, I'm almost grown.
Whoa, whoa.
Yeah, and I'm doing all right in school.
Not
they ain't said I broke no rule.
Not
I ain't never been in Dutch.
Not
I don't browse around too much.
Not
don't bother me, leave me alone.
Not
anyway, I'm almost grown.
Not
I don't run around with no mob.
Not
there was an interview he did for Rolling Stone with Mark Jacobson. Where he said, I saw that the white audience was 9 cents out of every dime. And it's true. His records sold more on the pop charts than they did on the R&B charts.
You know, I'd interviewed Johnny Johnson a few times, and he would say that people thought, before they actually saw Chuck Berry, that he was white.
Right.
And at the clubs that they would play, Even the African Americans would be doing country dances to the songs that Chuck was playing because of some of the rhythmic elements in the guitar that he was bringing. It wasn't just a blues feel, but there was also a pronounced country feel to it.
I'm gonna give you 30 days to get back home. I done called up a gypsy woman on the telephone. I'm gonna send out a worldwide hoodoo. That'll be the very thing that'll suit you. I'm gonna see that you be back home.
Do you buy the notion that has been handed out? You hear a lot in the last few days, you know, Chuck Berry invented rock and roll. How far do we take that?
Nobody invented rock and roll. If you look at it, it's clearly a collective invention by a whole bunch of people working on a given, I wanted to say, problem at the same time, and coming up with very similar results. I mean, you find this happening all the time in mathematics and science. And this is even more complicated than mathematics or science because it's the human soul, as it were. So, you know, nobody did the first rock and roll record. Nobody did the template for rock and roll. That's just not possible.
Who are the major suspects, though, preceding Berry? Who do you see Berry taking from? I mean, you mentioned Louis Jordan, T-Bone Walker, but clearly, you know, there's a before and after with Chuck Berry in terms of how this music evolved. I mean, I'm thinking specifically of the format, you know, a guitar-led combo, writing, you know, working with original songs by the leader of that band. I think that was fairly unprecedented at that point. I know there were other models.
There was the Chicago Blues model.
Sure.
Which was a guitar-led band, you know, Muddy Waters. It was Muddy who brought Chuck Berry to Chess Records.
She's all right, she's all right. She's all right, she's all right. She's all right, she's all right.
I think he saw something there that was not competition, because Muddy was always very, very aware of competition. He thought this was a guy who had something that nobody else had. Ike Turner, to some extent, had this going on with the Kings of Rhythm. B.B. King had it going on, but none of them had this narrative thing, and none of them had the teenage focus. I think those were the two things that were important.
Let's talk just a little bit about the guitar playing. You mentioned, you know, the narrative and the subject matter, the teens being central to the evolution of where the music was going through the music of Chuck Berry. But the guitar playing, too, I think was, you know, ground zero for so many subsequent guitars. What was different about how Chuck Berry played the electric guitar?
It uses the intrinsic nature of the electric guitar and the way it sounds through an amplifier as a very basic component of what it is. You know, the guitar was not a big instrument during the 1950s. The idea of a guitar fronting a band, a guitar hero, was pretty much limited to blues, at least until surf music came along, and that wasn't until 61, 62. So the idea of a lead guitar was fairly new, and it was Chuck Berry was one of the very few people whose guitar had a voice that was integral to each one of his compositions.
We've been talking to Ed Ward about Chuck Berry. He's the author of The History of Rock and Roll, Volume 1, 1920 through 1963. Ed, thanks for talking about Chuck with us.
Oh, it was my pleasure.
Greg, for much of the rest of the show, we are going to dive deep into some of Chuck Berry's songs and use those to illuminate different aspects of his career. I have to start at the beginning with Maybelline. It's 1955, his first release for Chess Records, his first big hit. It did not come, none of Chuck's music did, from a vacuum. In 1938, Bob Wills and his Texas Playboys, masters of country swing, recorded this song originally as a fiddle tune, Western Swing record called Ida Red.
chicken in the bread tray, pecking out dough. Granny, will your dog bite? No, child, no. Hurry up, boys, and don't fool around. Grab your partner and truck on down.
Ida Red, I'm plumb fool about Ida Red.
You know, it's interesting, Greg, that from the beginning, this song had an appeal that went far beyond the narrow genre audience. Wills has said that Ida Red was his favorite song to perform in the salt and pepper clubs. By that, he meant the racially integrated clubs. There weren't many, but the few that were, that had both black and white audiences, he would play this song. So Berry is in St. Louis. He has taken over the poor Johnny Johnson trio. He's leading this. He comes to Chicago in 55. He admires the blues musicians, especially Muddy Waters. Muddy makes the introduction to Leonard Chess. Chuck Berry has a couple of demos. Chuck thinks Leonard's going to be interested in the blues tracks, but Leonard responds to Ida Red / Ida May. He says, Leonard Chess, this is a hillbilly song sung by a black man. I can make money with that. Interesting. They up the beat in the recording studio. It gets amped up. Chuck has changed the lyrics. It becomes Maybelline. It's essentially the story of a girl and a boy and two cars, a Cadillac Coupe de Ville and a V8 Ford. Maybelline is driving the Coupe de Ville. She's got more speed. But in the end, the boy catches up at the top of a hill, and the song ends. We don't know what's going on. The girl, Maybelline, has been cheating on the boy. Maybelline, why can't you be true? It's not spelled out. She apparently was cheating on him, stepping out. He's trying to catch up to her. All right, that is the whole song. But the way the guitar and the drums move this tune, something you really hadn't heard in rock and roll before, you feel like you are speeding. It is not one of the great narrative songs that Berry will record. Those will come later. This is just him warming up. But what a great debut. When it comes out, it becomes an R&B hit on the black charts. I think Chuck Berry's as surprised as anyone that this record takes off, Greg. Here he is in 2000 talking to NPR about hearing Maybelline on the radio.
I flew home, you know, I was about 20 blocks from home, and told everybody. And I heard it. I heard me singing, and these are relatives. These are people who live on the block. So that was the first time I heard it, that day. Nice sunny day, beautiful day. Knocked me out to hear myself, you know.
What a song. Maybelline by Chuck Berry on Sound Opinion.
A Cadillac rolling on an open road. Nothing out of run my V8-4. A Cadillac doing about 95. Bumper to bumper rolling side to side. Maybelline, why can't you be true? Oh, Maybelline, why can't you be true? You done started back doing the thing you used to do. A Cadillac pulled up to 104. My phone got hot and wouldn't do no more.
It doesn't get any better than that. Maybelline by Chuck Berry, recorded May 21st, 1955.
After a short break, we're going to continue our discussion on the life of Chuck Berry and dig into more of his classic singles. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX. Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Greg Kot with Jim DeRogatis, and we're looking into the life, legacy, and music of the late, great Chuck Berry. We're looking at some of his greatest songs, and the next one I want to look at is School Day, 1957, Jim. I think this is where he really starts articulating his vision of what rock and roll is and what it meant to him. This was the music of freedom for Chuck Berry. This is my way of communicating with the world. This is the way of declaring myself a free man in this country, when I don't always feel like that when I walk down the street or I'm on tour. School Day, it comes under this kind of innocent rubric of, the day-to-day affairs of a student going through, class to class. And
ring,
it's kind
ring,
of a mundane thing.
Yeah, I got to go to class, right.
And there's the rhythm of that day after day after day. But, of course, you are waiting for that clock to, strike the end of the school day so that you are emancipated. So a deep metaphor here about what it felt like to be Chuck Berry in 1957, and by extension, speaking to a generation of teenagers who related to every word, because Chuck Berry was enunciating his words so perfectly. He was a guy who wanted to be understood.
He
placed a great deal of value in those words.
He talked about how he disliked the slurred diction of many of the blues artists. Even though he admired them, he wanted to be heard.
So right away in School Day, Jim, he's saying, "Hail, hail, rock and roll." This declaration of, this is the music that is going to set us free. Deliver me from the days of old. That is a multi-tiered message right there. Here's a guy who grew up in a racist society, and this is saying basically, we're turning a new chapter here, and it begins with this music. This is the music that's going to help set us free.
His grandparents were slaves.
Yes, I mean, here's a man who's coming out of a tradition that's pretty dire, and making a new world literally on those records that he was creating. The call and response between Chuck's voice and his guitar it cannot be overstated. That guitar was his second voice, and you can really hear that dialogue here in School Day. Ring, ring goes the bell, and the guitar answers.
Yeah.
This is the sound of freedom. This is Chuck Berry's School Day on Sound Opinions.
Up in the morning and out to school, the teacher is teaching the golden rule. American history and practical math, you study them hard and hoping to pass. Working your fingers right down to the bone, and the guy behind you won't leave you alone. Ring, ring goes the bell, the cook in the lunchroom's ready to sell. You're lucky if you can find a seat, you're fortunate if you have time to eat. Back in the classroom, open your books, gee, but the teacher don't know how mean she looks. Rolls around, you finally lay your burden down. Close up your books, get out of your seat. Down the halls and into the street. Up to the corner and round the bend. Right to the juke joint you go in. Drop the coin right into the slot. You gotta hear something that's really hot. With the one you love, you're making romance. All day long you've been wanting to dance. Feeling the music from head to toe. Round and round and round you go.
School Day from 1957, a classic from Chuck Berry, a great run of amazing songs during this era, Jim.
Greg, what we're trying to do with this Chuck Berry show is highlight the man's music and aspects that people may take so for granted that they forget about it. Chuck was someone who wanted to be an artist. My favorite quote from him was, "I grew up thinking art was pictures until I got into music and found out I was an artist and didn't paint." A decade before the Velvet Underground appears under the rubric of Andy Warhol with his cover art and says this is rock as art, Chuck was already thinking in those terms. Roll Over Beethoven, a 1956 hit single, is saying that. It was saying a lot of things, right? Got a crazy partner, you got to see him reel and rock. The number of times he uses the words rock or rock and roll in his singles. It's extraordinary. He is claiming this music. He did not invent it, as we went over with Ed Ward. There were a lot of paths converging at once to produce rock and roll. But he gave it a quality of we are in this together. This is a new sound, and I think it's art. The story goes that his sister, one of his sisters, monopolized the piano in the family living room. She was always playing her classical piano lesson music, so he couldn't get to the piano. That's fortuitous. He picks up the guitar. But he is familiar with Beethoven. He is familiar with Tchaikovsky. And if you look at the lyrics of Roll Over Beethoven, you know, Roll Over Beethoven, Tell Tchaikovsky the News, he is simultaneously referencing art that he thinks is as important and equal to Beethoven and Tchaikovsky. He name checks Early in the Morning, title of a Louis Jordan song, that jazz progenitor that influenced him strongly. He mentions Blue Suede Shoes, Carl Perkins, a peer that that he likes, which is rare. He doesn't speak very highly of many of his peers in the 50s. And the Hey Diddle Diddle part from the, you know, the Cat and the Fiddle is said to reference Bo Diddley, because both the kind of syncopation of Hey Diddle Diddle, Cat and the Fiddle, right? And also Bo was a violin player before he picked up that, you know, phenomenal rectangular guitar that is pure Bo Diddley. So he's positing rock and roll as art in 1956. And I just think it's brilliant. The other thing is the Berry attitude. Sly, sarcastic, risque. You know he's telling a dirty joke, even when it's not obvious. Conspiratorial, a wink and a nod. It's us against them, baby. It's the clued in versus the squares. It's the young, at least at heart, versus the old timers. It's the rebels versus the conservatives. I'm going to play the studio, the Chess recording of Roll Over Beethoven, but listen to this late 50s televised performance. Look it up on YouTube. It's extraordinary. The way he introduces the track, and he's clearly putting everybody on, talking to those of us who will get the joke and trying to tick off those who won't.
As a matter of fact, a relished memory in my mind he was, and a good musician, might I say so. This man was named Beethoven. No, he was named Beethoven. Ladies and gentlemen, I ask him to forgive us. Roll over and listen to a little of this.
Jumping little record I want my jockey to play. Roll over Beethoven, I gotta hear it again today. You know my temperature rising, the jukebox blowing a fuse. My heart beating rhythm and my soul keep a singing the blues. Roll over Beethoven, tell Tchaikovsky the news. I got the rockin' pneumonia, I need a shot of rhythm and blues. Caught the rolling off the writer sitting down at a rhythm review. A roll over Beethoven, they're rocking in 2x2. Well, if you feel it and like it, go get your lover, then reel and rock it. Roll it over, then move on up just a trifle further, then reel and rock with. Run another roll over Beethoven, dig these rhythm and blues.
Chuck Berry from 1956. This is art, and take that, Ludwig.
Exactly. You know, the art form of songwriting, said so well, Jim. Chuck Berry was the guy who got there first in terms of rock and roll songwriting, creating art out of rock and roll songs. A great example of that is Memphis, which he wrote in 1959. This is a song that has a very mature theme to it and a very sophisticated lyric. It is said that Chuck Berry spent a month working on the verses in this song to get it just right, because it had a particular tone and a particular delivery that was different from some of the material that he was recording around this time. Yes, there was a lot of music directed at teens. This music was clearly directed at an older audience in some ways. It is the young adult who has had experiences in the world. We find out in this song, sort of verse by verse, exactly what he's talking about. It's basically a one-sided conversation between the narrator in the song and a telephone operator, and he's pouring out his heart to this telephone operator. He's expressing that he's missing this girl named Marie, and that they're being kept apart by Marie's mother. We find that out after a while. And in the final verse, we finally find out who Marie is. She's, in fact, the six-year-old daughter of the narrator, and that the mother has left their home and took Marie with her, and he misses his daughter. And he's trying to find her.
He misses the daughter.
He's trying to find that number where his daughter called from so that he can actually hear her voice for himself. And it's a beautifully written song. Not only the way he sort of saves the ending, you know, but the girl's cheeks covered in hurry home drops at the end. I mean, what an image that is, because the girl, the daughter, misses her father just as much as the father misses the daughter. And they're feeling this across this long-distance connection that is never to be. The plaintive lyric, the plaintive delivery, the way Chuck's playing his guitar, we're seeing a songwriter, you know, growing before our eyes and ears in the 50s. Here's Memphis from Chuck Berry in 1959 on Sound Opinions.
Long distance information, give me Memphis, Tennessee. Help me find the party, trying to get in touch with me. She could not leave her number, but I know who placed the call. 'Cause my uncle took the message and he wrote it on the wall. Help me, information, get in touch with my Marie. Only one who'd phone me here from Memphis, Tennessee. Her home is on the south side, high up on a ridge, just a half a mile from the Mississippi Bridge.
Memphis from Chuck Berry in 1959 on Sound Opinions.
We'll look into the later years of Chuck Berry's career in a minute on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX. But we also want to hear your thoughts on the rock and roll icon. What did Chuck Berry mean to you? What are the musical standouts from his career in your book? Leave us a message for the air at 888-859-1800.
More than that I cannot add, only that I miss her and all the fun we had. But we were pulled apart because her mom did not agree and tore apart our happy home in Memphis, Tennessee. Last time I saw Marie, she's waving me goodbye with hurry home drops on cheek that trickle from her eye. Marie is only 6 years old. Information, please. Try to put me through to her in Memphis, Tennessee.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Greg Kot with Jim DeRogatis, and we are looking at the life, legacy, and music of Chuck Berry. And Jim, you and I are going to talk about one more song each from Chuck Berry's vast discography.
We could do dozens.
Oh, absolutely. But I really, really want to talk about Brown Eyed Handsome Man, which he released in 1956. A song like Brown Eyed Handsome Man, that was a pioneering song in terms of the subject matter. It's a very sly and daring commentary on race relations at a time when those kind of things weren't generally welcome.
A decade
on the radio.
Before the fruition of the civil rights movement.
That's right. So, as a African American gentleman who was now touring extensively around America, you know, he'd seen some things in the southern states, certainly, And this song is based on an incident he witnessed outside a concert that he was playing in California, where he saw a Hispanic man being handcuffed by the police, and a woman ran up screaming for the police to let him go. So he took that little image and transferred it into this amazing song about the African-American experience in America. You know, certainly, let's widen that out a little bit. People of color in the United States, a non-Caucasian man, a brown-eyed man, yeah, was basically his way of saying non-Caucasian.
You know, never direct, because the original line in Johnny B. Goode was a colored boy, and he changes it to country boy.
Right.
He never wanted to be too specific talking about race.
There was a little bit of a code going on, but anybody who was paying attention realized what the implications were. And this song is it hits you right between the eyes from the get-go. The brown-eyed handsome man is arrested basically for the crime of having no job. So it's this whole idea of, you know, who's getting jobs, who's employed, who is considered worthy of working in America, and expands it into this sort of heroic portrait. You know, there's art references in this song. The Venus de Milo lost her arms because she was so impassionately in love with the brown-eyed handsome man. And there's a reference to, you know, the breaking the color line in Major League Baseball.
Mm. Jackie Robinson.
There's a baseball hero running the bases at the end, hitting the game-winning home run. A clear reference to Jackie Robinson breaking the color barrier, you know, a decade earlier in Major League Baseball. So he's writing this song from a very much a perspective of who he is. So we see these songs about teenagers, you know, fighting the man and going up against institutions, not liking school, and coming out the victors. Now we transfer that to race relations and the brown-eyed handsome man, this heroic figure fighting against impossible odds. Brown-eyed handsome man from Chuck Berry in 1956 on Sound of Innocence.
Arrested on charges of unemployment, he was sitting in the witness stand. The judge's wife called up the district attorney. She said, free that brown-eyed man. If you want your job, you better free that brown-eyed man. Flying across the desert in a TWA, I saw a woman walk across the sand. She'd been walking 30 miles en route to Bombay to meet a brown-eyed handsome man. Her destination was a brown-eyed handsome man. Way back in history, 3,000 years, in fact, ever since the world began, there's been a whole lot of good women shedding tears over a brown-eyed handsome man. It's a lot of trouble with a brown-eyed handsome man.
Handsome man, Chuck Berry addressing the civil rights era in 1956 on Sound Opinions. Jim, what have you got as a final Chuck Berry song that you'd like to play?
Greg, I really want to dive deep into You Never Can Tell, but first I have to provide some history. We said earlier we'd mentioned Chuck's unfortunate brushes with the law. The first was when he was a teenager, carjacking, essentially. He claims the gun he would point in people's faces was unloaded. He does some time in reform school. Then I think most people realize this. The middle of his chess period is broken up by him spending about half of a 3-year sentence in prison for violating the Mann Act, transporting an underage girl across state lines for, this is the law, quotes, immoral purposes. He was convicted of that first. The conviction was overturned because the judge made racist comments. There'd been an earlier brush with the Mann Act with a legal age woman, and then he does time in prison. He comes out and begins recording for Chess again, and that's the period that yielded the song I'm going to talk about. There was one more stay in jail. In July 1979, Berry performs at the White House for President Jimmy Carter, who's a huge fan. 3 days later, he begins serving 120 days in federal prison and 4 years probation for income tax evasion. When you demand a suitcase full of cash before any gig you will play, and then you don't pay taxes on it,
you get in trouble.
You get in trouble. The last bout, infamously, with legal troubles was in the 1990s. Police raided his home outside St. Louis, found marijuana and videotapes that he had filmed in a club he owned where he placed video cameras in the women's restrooms. You know, Chuck and his legal problems, I think a big part of the reason his death was honored and commemorated, but not with the tears that greeted, you know, David Bowie just last year, right, or Prince, is there was a lot of controversy in his background.
Sure, extremely complicated life.
And it's a disturbing legacy. As I said, he does his second stint in prison because of the Mann Act violations. He comes out and he begins recording again for Chess in 1962. So the first run of hits is 55 through when he goes to prison, 62 into the early 70s. There are some great songs. No Particular Place to Go, one of his greatest guitar riffs. Nadine. Mm-hmm. Nadine, I think he's even fonder of than Maybelline, the way he sings her name. And the song I'm going to talk about, You Never Can Tell. C'est la vie, say the old folks, you never can tell. This is one of those great short stories in a song. Chuck is talking about a couple in New Orleans, a Creole couple, apparently. They don't have any money. All of the elders tell them they're foolish to get married. It's not going to work out. You have no prospects. You have no money. But it does work out. All they need to be happy are, quote, 700 little records, all rock, rhythm, and jazz. But when the sun goes down, the rapid tempo of the music falls. All right. They're in love. And that's getting them through. I think this underscores a key point that I want to make about Berry. We've talked about, you know, the race relations aspect. We've talked about the music being so innovative. Greg, I think his secret was the second person plural pronoun. When Nirvana sang in Smells Like Teen Spirit, here we are now, entertain us. We are stupid and contagious. Berry is constantly singing about us as a group. At this point, after prison, he's in his early 30s. He's not a teenager, but he sings about us teens, we, us in this together. As I said earlier, it's the hips versus the squares. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the rebels versus the conservatives. He's one of us. We are with him. And that sort of unity in a song like, hey, say the old folks, you never can tell. Don't listen to them. Listen to us. It's a kind of inclusion that hadn't been heard, I think, in rock and roll, because he got there first, and that it endures to this day. You Never Can Tell by Chuck Berry, a big hit in 1964 on Sound Opinions.
It was a teenage wedding, and the old folks wished him well. You could see that Pierre did truly love the mademoiselle. And now the young monsieur and madame have rung the chapel bell. C'est la vie, say the old folks, it goes to show you never can tell. They furnished off an apartment with a two-room robot sale. The coolerator was crammed with TV dinners and ginger ale. But when Pierre found work, the little money coming worked out well. C'est la vie, say the old folks, it goes to show you never can tell. Show you never can tell. They bought a souped up chitney, was a cherry red 53, and drove it down to Orleans to celebrate the anniversary. It was there where Pierre was wedded to the lovely mademoiselle. C'est la vie, said the old folks, go to show you never can tell.
You Never Can Tell, a big hit for Chuck Berry in the early 60s, comes back, Greg, many years later as a key song in Pulp Fiction,
yeah.
Quentin Tarantino. And by that point, it's pretty much over, right? You know, after My Ding-a-Ling in the early 70s, Chuck, his heart is not in recording. The flood of new material stops. He travels from town to town playing many, 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 many gigs, getting paid in cash, and is an oldies act.
Yeah, it's unfortunate that that's the way most people remember him. I mean, he effectively stopped recording in 1979. He actually had some pretty decent songs in the 70s. He also had some pretty lousy songs in the 70s, but there are gems on those recordings in the late 60s, early 70s that some people have ignored, in part because Chuck never played them in concert. He basically struck to the same format over and over again. Cash and carry routine, you know, going from gig to gig, hired gun bands on the road, some of which were good, some of which weren't. You know, noted for abusing his bands on the road if they didn't know Chuck Berry music as well as he did. So he became sort of a bitter figure. And we saw some of that in the movie Hail, Hail, Rock and Roll.
Yeah.
You know, Taylor Hackford's documentary in 1986. So, you know, around this time he's being inducted in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, one of the first group of inductees. And here is this figure who comes across as not really being all that happy with his life and not really being happy with the way he is being remembered by the many artists who, you know, built on his innovations and in many ways profited much more profoundly from them. So, you know, the images we have of Chuck Berry aren't all that flattering at the end of his career. It needs to be said that he was playing a regular gig in St. Louis that became quite legendary. When he was on his home turf and playing these residencies in St. Louis, he was quite effective in that setting. It was when he went on the road that things didn't go so well.
I saw a memorable show in Columbia, Missouri, where Johnny Johnson actually joined him on keyboards, and those two had a contentious relationship. Johnson had to sue him to get monies he felt he was owed. I felt honored. That was a good night to see those two play together. But he was infamous for the last 40 years for picking up a band for hire in every town. No rehearsal, no set list. You just follow me. We wanted to talk to a musician who worked with him under those circumstances. Stephen Gillis, drummer from Chicago, played with Berry at his last show in Chicago. Stephen, many people talk about Chuck being notoriously difficult to deal with if you're backing him as a musician. What was your experience like?
Yeah, I obviously that's a, you know, that's what we've all heard. I didn't experience that personally at all. They got him to the venue like just in time so that we could have like a real brief sound check. And we played about a half a tune. Well, before we played, he walked and he said, "Where's my band?" And actually, I thought this is great. This is how musicians talk to each other. Where's my band?
Yeah.
So he rolled into the stage, and we all just kind of circled around him, and he was really nice. We shook hands, and he had a couple things just to say. He said, you know, my hearing is really not well right now, or something like that. And you know, I may turn around and ask you what chord I'm playing. And so we were all, you know, kind of like, oh, okay, we need to pay extra attention here. And but other than that, he just said, you know, just watch when I start and stop a tune. And you know, if you hear any stories about Chuck and his pickup bands, it's like you got to nail his endings, because he may stop the tune at any time. He'll be in the middle of a chorus of a tune and just want to stop. And so you know, we all had our eyes peeled, and you have to be right in the moment, right there listening. And and I, you know, I saw it coming. I saw he was going to stop the tune. It was an odd spot, kind of. You know, he put his foot down and whap, you know, ended the tune. And we did, you know, it went off without a hitch. And he turned around and blew me a kiss, which I wasn't expecting at all. But
those
I got really lucky.
Rights. Those are
incredible.
Let's back up a second. Chuck was infamous for demanding payment in cash up front before playing a note on stage. Did you see that transaction?
I didn't actually see the transaction, but I know that transaction occurred, yes.
What was your perspective on Chuck's music before you played that gig? And did that night change anything for you in terms of your feelings about Chuck Berry?
Absolutely. That night didn't change anything. It just, I made my living playing music that he inspired or essentially created. So I just couldn't even believe that I was there playing with him. It was just like such an honor. He is American music. He started it. You know, it's like him and Muddy Waters and B.B. King and Buddy Guy. I mean, these guys, we wouldn't have a life or a career in music or anything without these guys. It's just incredible that I had a chance to play with them.
We've been talking to Stephen Gillis, co-owner of Transient Sound in Chicago, session drummer of longstanding in Chicago, played with Chuck Berry at his last Chicago gig in 2011. Stephen, thank you for being on the show.
Thank you very much.
So it's clear that Chuck Berry's influence goes on and on. It has lasted decades, a half century, Jim, influencing, you know, the Beach Boys and the Rolling Stones and the Beatles, bands of that ilk, almost immediately after Chuck Berry came out. But the genres that he has touched on, his songs play in every genre: reggae, country, hip-hop, punk, metal, jam bands. They've all adopted Chuck Berry's music as their own. Here are just a few of the artists who have taken inspiration from or covered Chuck Berry's music.
If everybody had an ocean across the USA, then everybody'd be surfing like California.
Well, she was just 17, if you know what I mean. And the way she looked was way beyond compare.
John is in the basement mixing up the medicine. I'm on the pavement thinking about the government. The man in a trench coat, badge out, laid off, says he's got a bad cough, wants to get it paid off.
She quit high school to make a fortune in the promised land. She got a job behind the counter in an all-night hamburger stand.
Now the other son, Madame, had rung the chapel bell. C'est la vie, say the old folks, it goes to show you never can tell.
There's two that old hot made of earth and wood. There lived a country boy named Johnny B. Goode.
I never have a love to read or write so well, but he can bloom your tongue just like a ringing bell. Go, 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 Johnny, go.
Go, 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 Johnny, go. Go, Johnny, go.
Oh, that montage is barely scraping the surface, Greg. It is clear that Chuck Berry's music lives on in everything that has followed. In fact, it'll live on well into the future. His records, let's not forget, are included on the Voyager spacecraft, which is trying to make contact with alien civilizations beyond our galaxy. What do we have on the show next week?
Next week, Jim, we are going to give our report from the South by Southwest Music Conference and play a bunch of bands that made a big impression there on both you and I.
Greg, Sound Opinions is produced, as always, by Brendan Banasak, Evan Chung, Alex Claiborne, and Iona Contreras.
You say you love me, darling. Please call me on the phone sometime.
On Sound Opinions, everyone's a critic. So give us a call on our hotline, 888-859-1800.
You say you love me, darling. Please call me on the phone sometime.
New messages.
Hi, Jim and Greg. This is Martin calling from Chelsea, Quebec. My desert island pick is Frank Zappa's Peaches on Regalia. It's a perfect song. Is it rock? Is it jazz? Is it classical? It's all of those and more. But my main reason for picking it is that it's one of the most cheerful instrumentals in existence. If I was stranded on a desert island, I'd want something to lift my spirits, and Peaches on Regalia always does the trick. Thanks very much. Enjoy your show.
I'm calling from Downers Grove, Illinois, with my desert island jukebox selection. And my selection would be Thankful for What You Got by William Devon.
You may not have a car at all. Brothers and sisters, you can still stand tall. Just be thankful for what you got.
Listen to it over and over, and I can't think of a better song to have on a desert island, because you need to be thankful for what you got.
I'm calling to give my reason as to my selection for your Desert Island Jukebox. This is Randy Johnson of Chicago, Illinois. I've become an old man who's heard a lot of great music in my life. However, if I was to choose only one song to put on the solar-powered Desert Island Jukebox, it would be Paul Simon's Obvious Child. The music would get you to move, perhaps march around the palm trees and dance on the sandy beach. In quieter moments, the lyrics themselves would lead you to contemplate the truth and image of your life and catapult you beyond your interior walls. So, in summary, why deny the obvious, child? Thank you very much. Good day.
Well, I've been waking up at sunrise. I've been following the light across my room. I watch the night receive the moon of my day. Some people say the sky is just the sky, but I say, why deny the obvious, child? Why deny the obvious, child?
Hey, Tim and Greg, this is Old Man Ben here in Los Angeles, and you guys have been on a great run lately, all these great shows recently. It's been spectacular, and I love how it showed real reverence for music of the past. And then you had this band on called String Bean, Soybean, something or other, and I gotta say, they didn't seem to have any sense of history about music. They seemed to, they compared themselves with Nirvana and Noi and Led Zeppelin, and then they proceeded to play the most mediocre music I've heard in a long time. And I think it comes through that they didn't really seem to have any sense of history of music. They didn't have any respect for artists that came before them, because no self-respecting artist would dare say that they're as good as Led Zeppelin or Nirvana or anything like that. And they're kids, and I get that. So, thanks for making me feel super old. Have a good one. Keep up the good work.
To share your opinions on Sound Opinions, call 888-859-1800. We'll be back next week on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and distributed by PRX.